In the markets this week, the Dow Industrials closed at the highest point in its 118-year history. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, back with you with what could be the biggest show of the year. It's a pleasure to be with you this weekend. We've got top guest interviews from leading financial gurus, as well as the business headlines and analysis affecting your portfolio for you. First at bat, chief investment strategist at Sprott Asset Management for over a decade, John Embry, sees important signs that the precious metals market has bottomed, including accelerating gold shortages, which will ultimately culminate, he says, with a disconnect between the paper and the physical markets. The rumors are true. There's little to no available bullion left in sovereign vaults. The gold has been rehypothecated. He throws listeners a life preserver, though, in the form of two of his favorite precious metal stock tickers, including Lakeshore Gold. But the exciting news is for silver investors. Bears have shorted an entire year's worth of silver mining output, a fact that could propel the price beyond the recent $50 peak to $150 or more, as billions of investors come to terms with a global currency reset. Next at the plate, Boston University economist and author of the new bestseller, The Clash of the Generations, Professor Kotlikoff, says that every investor must own precious metals, especially given that the official $17 trillion national debt figure is way off base. The true number is more than 10 times larger, $225 trillion, when we include unfunded liabilities. A few brave members of Congress have addressed the domestic Ponzi scheme, like Dr. Ron Paul, and Robert Ian wraps up the show, bringing all the runners across home plate with another Grand Slam report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weatherman with a market weather report. Gold jumped the most in 4 weeks after a Malaysian airline plane crashed in Ukraine and Israel sent ground forces into the Gaza Strip. Nevertheless, solid domestic economic numbers led to a dollar rally, which took some of the air out of the precious metals markets. By Friday's closing bell in the New York COMEX exchange, the metal was off about $28, ending still well above $1,300 at $1,311. Higher for the year by nearly 10%. Silver gave back about half a dollar, finishing at just shy of 21. Nevertheless, palladium bucked the trend, gaining $7, closing at 881, the only precious metal to gain this week, on continued supply concerns from Russia, the world's top palladium producer, and some investors worried that escalating tensions in Eastern Europe could lead to more trade sanctions against Russia, potentially curbing supplies of the metal. Palladium is primarily used for devices to control pollution, like catalytic converters and automobiles. And, of course, European car sales last month rose for the 10th consecutive month. That's the longest stretch of gains in about 4 years. The price has also climbed this year after the five-month strike crippled output in South Africa, the second largest producer. Platinum is also used in catalytic converters, but price has still yielded $23, ending at $14.91 an ounce, now that the workers' strike in South Africa has passed. And West Texas Intermediate crude, though, added a dollar, ending at 101. The top story influencing the markets this week, geopolitical concerns in Eastern Europe, which ratcheted up several notches on Thursday. Gold futures posted the biggest gain in 4 weeks following reports that a Malaysian jet carrying nearly 300 people was downed, according to Ukrainian officials, by rebels in the area near the border with Russia. The Boeing 777 flight from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur was reportedly downed by a missile near the eastern town of Terez, according to Ukraine's Interior Ministry. In response, the U.S. and European Union imposed further stringent sanctions on Russian businesses. Nevertheless, Russia and Ukraine blamed one another for the jet crash. The event only exacerbated violence between Ukrainian and separatist forces. On Friday, the President of the United States outlined plans to increase diplomacy and put military operation in abeyance for the time being. In other geopolitical news, tensions are flaring in the Middle East as Israel Thursday launched a ground invasion of Palestinian Gaza with thousands of troops, tanks, and armored vehicles following a 10-day aerial assault on the region. Investors directed funds into gold as well as the U.S. dollar as safe haven alternatives. Bottom line on the precious metals. Well, after 6 weeks of higher closes, the precious metals rally paused this week. That's typical profit taking. Nevertheless, gold is holding firm at solid support with signs of very strong accumulation evident in the weekly chart. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, mostly sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange, with the Dow Industrials closing at yet another all-time record, the best close in nearly 120 years of trading. Investors cheered the sanguine employment figures, which suggested that consumers will continue with their buying spree, boosting corporate sales and profits as well as equities prices. For the week, the Dow added 156, ending at 17,100. The S&P 500 picked up 10 points, wrapping up at 1978, while the NASDAQ added 16, closing at 4,432. Meanwhile, the U.S. dollar rallied this week amid news that the Fed may have to raise its benchmark lending rate sooner than expected, following comments from James Bullard, president of the St. Louis Fed, who noted improving employment and accelerating inflation. Employers added jobs to their payrolls in 33 states last month, while unemployment declined in 22 states, adding to advances in the labor market. The index of leading indicators also moved up last month, signaling that the nascent recovery is in full swing. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our seven-component sentiment index pendulum finally swung from the greedy category into the fearful. In fact, a surprising amount of fear entered the market in just 1 week. And this is particularly bullish, I think, especially given that the Dow Industrials closed at a new high. For the rest of this report and all of your stock picks, be sure and log into the Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Here's a health tip for the week. You may have read Dr. Mark Hyman's research, which proves sugar is 7 times more addictive than narcotics. But did you know that flour, i.e. wheat, bread, pastas, grains, just as bad? He suggests avoiding sugar and flour like the plague and embracing tasty high-protein vegetables like lentils, beans, legumes, sweet potatoes, almonds, walnuts, cashews. We're following his plan with solid results here at the Waltzek household. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Professor Kotlikoff and Mr. John Embry. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Today's featured guest on GoldSeek Radio says the United States is bankrupt and flat broke. The U.S. is in fiscally worse shape, maybe even than Greece. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff, a professor of economics at Boston University and author of The Clash of the Generations, as well as the Inform Act, focused on improving the welfare of every American. Welcome back, Professor Kotlikoff.
Pleasure to be with you.
In your latest page-turner, Clash of the Generations, you and Scott Burns outline an interesting 60-year government Ponzi scheme here. You show that consumption has soared while savings have dwindled for the typical American. You know, this is a peculiar anomaly. How can consumption skyrocket while savings dwindle?
You have a certain amount of income, national income, and if you consume more of it, you're going to have, by definition, less saving and therefore less money to invest, because your income is can either be spent or saved. Nothing else can happen with it. So that's true for a household. It's also true for a country. And over the last 60 years, the government's been taking ever more resources from younger people, including future generations, and giving them to older generations to consume. And each generation has taken its turn at this game of take as you go. And I'm talking about transfers, not just in the form of Social Security benefits, but also Medicare benefits, Medicaid benefits, tax cuts that differentially help the elderly, just tax cuts in general that leave, you know, larger official debts to the young. So, and it's also, there's been a shift in the tax structure away from taxing the income of owners of assets and towards taxing wages. Now, who's got assets? It's older people. And who's got wages? It's younger people. So there's all these things that have been going on in many different ways that have entailed an expropriation of the young by each successive generation of the old. And my generation, the baby boomers, are about to, are standing in line to do this as well. Nobody's looking at the big picture, which is the magnitude of the burden of the bills for our children. Because most of the bills are off the books. Most of the bills we can't see because they've been labeled in a way to keep them off the books in accounting that would make Enron or Bernie Madoff blush. So you have enormous liabilities to pay for Social Security benefits, for Medicare benefits, Medicaid benefits, For defense spending, we have to, you know, pay for the government's military in the future. We've got all kinds of expenditures that we have to pay for, and we also have all kinds of taxes that are coming due. But the taxes, as projected by the CBO, are $205 trillion short of the revenues as projected by the CBO when you value everything in the present. So we've got a $205 trillion fiscal gap based on the CBO's, Congressional Budget Office's own projections released last October. The official debt's only $12 trillion. So we're hiding almost all of the liabilities, net of the taxes to cover those liabilities, with this bookkeeping that we're doing and the failure to do fiscal gap and generational accounting, which the Inform Act would require. So, yeah, we're running a Ponzi scheme. Yeah, we're broke. Yeah, we're probably in worse shape than Greece. Yeah, we're far worse shape than Detroit. Social Security by itself is in far worse shape than Detroit's pension system. And nobody's looking at that picture except some members, you know, some brave members of Congress come along every so often and they start talking about it. And then, you know, they might propose something and not get reelected. But this is generational theft, pure and simple. We always say that we love our children and that we care the most about our children, but we seem to hate everybody else's children. We have to understand in this country that our children are everybody's children. You know, in other words, your child is my child or my child is your child when it comes to the education system, when it comes to the healthcare system, when it comes to how much taxes we're going to leave the next generation. We're in this together. And we have to start seeing other people's children as our children. It's got to be our kids are us, not Toys R Us.
We have to think about the work environment that they'll be facing, because you covered healthcare, education, but we're seeing just an erosion in the quality of employment available to graduating students, whether it be high school, college, graduate school, underemployment, if you will. Any comments?
Yeah, no, it's horrible. I know so many college graduates who are doing jobs that it would be unheard of for a college grad to be doing if they can find any job whatsoever, if they're not employed for a year. So it's a really, you know, people have gone to really excellent schools and paid a lot of money out of their own pocket or their parents' pocket. So we're suffering or facing very intense competition from folks across the oceans in different countries, not just China, but really we're competing with people all over the world in a way that wasn't the case, because the internet makes able to do business abroad, to import goods that are produced abroad at a cheaper price, or to hire engineering, computer software engineering, whatever, over abroad. But we also have competition with human automation via the form of smart machines. I say human automation because humans have developed the software code that is now being embedded in smart machines, which is replacing humans. And there's very few things you can think of, apart from maybe from a massage you can get from a machine quite well. There are very few things you can think of that a machine can't do. It can shoot our enemies. It can take their purchases. It can, collect tolls on the highway. It can drive our cars shortly. It'll deliver our packages via drone or whatever. That's all coming. In the past, we had technological change, which didn't seem to be so substitutable for humans. But this form of robot technology, smart machine technology, seems to be able to directly compete with humans. So, yeah, the fact that we've got that, those two things on the plate, the fact that we're under-educating our children, we're not seriously investing in their education, we're wasting trillions on, or at least, you know, probably at least over a trillion in wars that obviously are not winnable, that have been a total waste of money and lives and bodies. I mean, just a total disgrace to have spent 10 years in Iraq and then have that entire military fall apart in 10 minutes. Same thing's happening, probably will happen in Afghanistan. And think of all the young men and women who sacrificed their lives and bodies for a good cause, but it was poor leadership at the top for somebody's prestige. George Bush wanted to say he was a top military commander. Well, let him go fight and get maimed. for life. He didn't do that with no real plan to win. It was a cowardly thing to leave our kids in Afghanistan with no real plan to win. So, and this kind of cowardly behavior by older men who don't have their own kids or their own lives at stake, and we saw that in Vietnam. I think when we commit our military, we need to, and the cost of that military, human otherwise material, we should know what we're doing and have a game plan for winning or pull out as soon as we figure out we can't win.
You raise so many interesting points here. For instance, you talk about the replacement of jobs by smart technology, smartphones. We find it everywhere. There's smart washers, dryers, microwave ovens. I was in a friend's car the other day. Thing was talking and giving instructions. I mean, it's just a remarkable situation. But you're right. You know, it is replacing jobs. Maybe you could tell folks why this is different from the classical John Henry, the hammer in his hand versus the railroad pneumatic drill there. Why is it different this time? I mean, could there really be a revolution of machines and robotics and smart technologies that causes an employment vacuum?
You know, it may be the combination of the technology coming on board and other products not coming on board that people can actually that need a lot of people or that don't have a lot of competition to make those products. So, you know, we've had a lot of technological improvement in agriculture, and it led to an enormous reduction in the workforce in agriculture. But people were able to find other jobs, maybe because they weren't competing with so many people from abroad. In effect, the transportation costs and the communication costs have come down so much. But also, you know, if you think about the horse and buggy that gave way to the car, to this, think about a taxi back when we had horses and carriages. There was a driver and the horses, right, and the buggy. And that was, okay, then the taxi comes along, the car comes along, there's still a driver, different means of transportation, but there's still a driver. Now we're going to have a driverless car. So we're going to have driverless taxis. That's going to put all the taxi cab drivers and all the Euler, whatever it's called, drivers out of business. Can't say that we didn't have smarter machines back in 1880 when, you know, we got put in a, or when we developed the railroad, when that first was invented, that that wasn't a, in effect, a smart machine that was going to take away a lot of jobs. It did, but other things came along. We now have, you know, you kind of think about if machines can do everything, what can people do that the machines can't do except hold hands?
You're right. Many of those jobs were lost in the horse and buggy, and the buggy whip, I think, is a classic example. But, you know, it did spark an industrial revolution. Are we going to have a society filled with programmers that program and maintain machines?
Because I'm actively doing research on this where, you know, we economists try and write down models and then not just static, but we look at what happens through time. And one of the things that happens is that when we introduce these smart machines, this technology, well, the programmers first get paid a whole lot because this technology can now be used and has a lot of uses so that they get a big return. But then when all that code gets embedded, you suddenly don't need so much programmers, as many programmers as anymore. Because think about Big Blue, that computer that has become the best chess player in the world. It doesn't have to get any better to beat forever every human on the planet, whoever comes along. We don't need an even better Big Blue. We've already built it. It's there forever. And so the computer programmers will likely suffer a big drop in their wages in the future, but there'll be some hire just to maintain the code. But the old code is going to be competing with the new programmers. The other thing to say here is that when people don't have jobs, when younger people are put out of jobs or they're put into lower paying jobs, they can't save as much, so they can't accumulate the material wealth that they would otherwise have accumulated. So if you kind of model saving and investment and what we call capital formation in the context of this kind of generational problem arising from technological change, where the older people kind of reap the reward, the return to this investment in robots, and the younger people reap lower wages, well, the younger people aren't there to, in effect, buy the output of these machines, and through time, there's less material wealth in the economy, and people in the long run can actually end up better, worse off. Everybody can end up worse off in the simulations, even though the technology is better, because there's less material wealth that's been accumulated, less capital around for people to work with. So we can simulate this entire process of technological change, making everybody worse off through time, except the initial owners of the technology who benefit, initial inventors. So, you know, the key question about the technology is, aren't these new cars terrific? They can drive themselves, blah, blah, blah. But the second question is, who's going to have any money to buy those cars if nobody has a job? And these are two very interconnected questions, and when we simulate the interconnection between those questions, you can end up with a society that's actually worse off on balance forever. So, you know, economists aren't called the dismal scientists for nothing. But it's very simple to get this kind of result. I wrote a paper with a professor at Columbia named Jeff Sachs. He's pretty well known, much more famous than me. Here's a paper that's on my website at kotlikoff.net that you can find under articles. Shows the math of this happening and simulates it, and doing a more elaborate version of that with some other people, including Jeff.
I'll look forward to reading that article, and I hope our listeners will as well. Very interesting topic, but I'd like to shift over here to another topic you bring up in your latest book here, bestseller. You go on to note that the middle class has been eviscerated, and we're seeing signs of this, you know, almost everywhere. From the recent foreclosure deluge, which I think hit the middle class and working classes the hardest, as well as in EBT debit and food stamp card programs, 47 million participants. But perhaps nowhere else does it seem to be showing up than in real inflation-adjusted income levels. And we've already touched on that a bit, but Americans earn less on average than they did decades ago. You seem to have some idea of a solution here. What's it going to take to get people better paying jobs?
Well, we have to get our fiscal house in order so that we don't leave astronomical bills to our kids. That's going to take comprehensive health care reform, not having a Medicare system that's going broke, a Medicaid system that's going broke, Obamacare system's about to probably explode in costs when employers shut down, send their employees over to get Obamacare, and they realize that it's a lot cheaper to get it, to pay a penalty, a small penalty, and not cover their workers. It's cheaper to ship them over to Obamacare and where they can get these subsidies. So Obamacare is likely to explode in costs. And then we've got employer-based health care, which the premiums for that are tax-free. So a larger and larger share of our compensation is not being hit by taxation because it's coming in the form of premium payments for these insurance policies, which is basically going into the pockets of the medical industry for procedures and medications that aren't making us any healthier than countries are spending a whole lot less on healthcare. So the Purple Health Plan at thepurpleplans.org, you can take a look. That is a plan for having a basic health insurance policy for every American, done in a way that won't drive us broke, that won't still entail private provision, that won't allow anybody to discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. It's a very simple postcard-length fix, which a number of Nobel laureates have endorsed. There's a Social Security solution there, which involves freezing the existing system, which is 32% underfinanced and a complicated nightmare. I have a software company. We have a program called Maximize My Social Security, which I've had three engineers working on for years to get exactly correct all the details of the Social Security system. It's actually more complicated than the entire federal income tax, the Social Security system. So you need extremely smart software to figure out what to do with it. I write a column every week on the PBS NewsHour site about Social Security and answering questions, and just amazing you could not make a system more complicated. You could have Russian bureaucrats could not come up with anything. We need to fix the tax system. There's this proposal there at the purpletax.org, but you also, there's another proposal I wrote up called the commonsensetax.org. So there we have to fix education. We have to, we're not spending enough on the teachers. The classroom sizes are too large. We have to come up, you know, use technology there to our advantage to get the best lectures remotely in front of every single kid in the country, because kids aren't getting solid education. And we have to work hard on vocational training for the kids who want to move in that direction. You know, we have to follow some of the lead of what Germany and Switzerland are doing. They don't have the kind of unemployment problems. We should look at how they're educating people and how they're training kids, and we should just follow exactly what they're doing, because somehow they're getting it right in this day and age. The environmental, we need to have we're leaving a climate that has huge potential risks and costs to our kids, which we're facing up to. So we need to have a carbon tax and take the lead in keeping the world from going over a tipping point with respect to climate change and global warming. Nobody knows for sure what the deal is there, including the top scientists, but the top scientists all agree, well, virtually all of them agree, that we're close to a tipping point and that things are getting, and we have to realize that this is, are going to leave enormous bills, a climate that's extremely dangerous and hostile, and an undereducated next generation. Is that the American dream? And the wages of American workers today, apart from these fringe benefits, in real dollars are no higher on average, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, than they were in 1965. That right there is a statement about the end of the American dream. It's happened.
No, exactly. And I think you really hit on some important topics there. You know, modeling our education system on those which are working. I mean, those that are getting results. Take a look at China. You mentioned Germany and Switzerland. China, they're getting results. We are up against the world when it comes to education. And we've got to start preparing people with a little bit more, our students with a little bit more than just feel good, warm, fuzzy information. They need an arsenal, a toolkit to go to work. And you suggest that no brokerage account is safe. I found this article fascinating. You published at least two on the topic.
I'm writing a third one today, so it'll come out shortly. In the aftermath of the Madoff scandal and the failure of Madoff's brokerage account, the insurance entity called CIPIC, the Securities Investors Protection Corporation, which is basically a front for a bunch of Wall Street firms, they own and operate CIPIC. They were supposed to make good on their insurance commitments to all the Madoff victims. Well, there are a lot of Madoff victims, and if you multiply $500,000, which is kind of the amount that probably on average that CIPIC people lost, you know, far, far more than $500,000, which is what CIPIC was promising to pay. But for years, they had been collecting premiums from companies like Goldman Sachs of $150 a year for all the brokerage accounts that Goldman Sachs has, $150 a year from J.P. Morgan for all the thousands, whatever, hundreds of thousands of brokerage. Yeah, $150. So they were running, CIPIC was running a scam itself, an insurance scam, telling everybody that there was this insurance. Then Madoff goes under. Then people turn and say to CIPIC, give us, you know, we've lost this amount of money. Some of it was beyond $500,000. Give us $500,000 that you promised. CIPIC turned around and said, they said to themselves, I'm sure, we don't have the money to cover this. So let's come up with some way to keep from paying. So what they came up with was the idea that if you had put money into the account and taken out over time more than you put in, which is, if you think about it, if I put in, let's say, $200,000 today and I let it grow, or maybe, you know, over the next 10 years, I put in $20,000 a year, I save, okay? I save in a brokerage account, and I let it grow. Maybe I do this when I'm in my 30s, now I'm in my 70s, I'm retiring. I've got an account that can be quite large because of compound interest. And that's really what we invest for, to be able to take out more than we put in, right? Why else would we invest? So we take out our money, we spend it, okay? We now face two things from SIPC when we go and ask for the five. Maybe we take out, you know, a third of our money, and we leave the rest in there. So basically all our retirement savings is left in that account. It goes under. SIPC can't cover. SIPC declares it to be a Ponzi scheme, which they can do with really any fraud, any brokerage account that goes under, they can claim it was a Ponzi scheme. It's pretty easy to do that because there's no clear definition of a Ponzi scheme. You can even argue that Madoff was not a Ponzi scheme based on its overall operations. But they call, anyway, so they can declare it a Ponzi scheme. If you took out, if a third of your money that you took out exceeded what you put in, which it should over a long period of time, you're a net winner, according to SIPC, and therefore you're not owed a penny on the $500,000 of insurance. So you might have lost, you know, $1 million, $2 million. And because you took out more than you put in, you get back not a penny. But the story gets actually worse than that. Whatever you took out in the prior 6 years, because if your brokerage is located in New York, headquartered in New York City, or New York State, sorry, you're subject to New York State law, according to SIPC. So, according to New York State law, SIPC can go after you for every dollar that you took out over the prior 6 years before the fraud was discovered, and sue you for that to the extent that that amount is less than your total withdrawals over your entire course of you're over the 40 years that you had put the money in net of any contributions you put in. So if you, well, let me give you an example here. If you put in, $200,000 four or five decades ago, and it grew to maybe $3 million, which is, could easily happen, given compounding and historic rates of return on the stock market, if you thought that money was safe, you took out the money, $1 million, and so you're viewed as a net winner to the tune of $800,000. Your brokerage account goes under. You had your statement after you'd taken out, you know, what this money. Your statement read that you still had $1.5 million as a balance. Well, you go and ask for $500,000 to cover the $1.5 million loss. You get nothing. Furthermore, since you've taken out $1 million over the past 6 years, they can sue you for $800,000. They can sue you for all your withdrawals over the past 6 years, up to what's called the difference between what you put in over the lifetime of the account and what you took out, which from my assumption here was $800,000. So they can sue you for up to $800,000. So you won't get paid the insurance that they promised you. And you'll also get turned around and get sued for $800,000. So you've lost your entire retirement savings. And now they're suing you to take your house or your vacation home. This is not insurance. This is risk generation. This is an insurance scam, which is putting everybody who has a brokerage account in the entire country at risk. If you take any money, if you do what every investor hopes, which is to make more money than you put in, take it out and spend it, you can't sleep at night for the next 6 years. Because if you spend that money and it turns out that within 6 years, some fraud is declared in that brokerage account, in that brokerage firm, it doesn't have to be, you know, connected to your specific account or your specific broker, just has to be the brokerage firm goes under, because maybe the broker down the hall in that company was the bad apple. Anyway, SIPC can come and sue you back for every dollar you took out and spent over the last 6 years. So this is why I wrote a column called Close Your Brokerage Account, and because it's not safe. It's just I wouldn't put a penny in a brokerage account at this point. There is a bill in front of Congress which would fix this problem, and I discussed that in the columns that I wrote. And we need to get anybody who's got a brokerage account today to not say they should take their money out, not spend it for 6 years to be perfectly safe, and then they can have the opportunity to spend it without risk of being clawed back by SIPC. You don't know who the brokerage is going to hire in the next 2 years, 3 years, 5 years if you take your money out today. But over that entire time, if they go under because of a fraud, you're liable for every penny you took out today of your account. So this is what SIPC has done to save Wall Street from paying its the claims that were rightfully should have been paid to the victims of the Madoff fraud. So we've all been made into Madoff victims, the entire population, by SIPC.
You know, it's almost reminiscent of what we saw there with Cyprus and, of course, the Polish pension scam, where they lost about half of their pension. I mean, there seems to be all this legislation behind the scenes that's putting those who used to be insulated from this type of threat of confiscation, if you will. And we can, for the most part, we're all on the hook now, is what it looks like. Do you agree?
It's not just the people who, you know, the Madoff victims were scammed twice by Madoff and then by SIPC, large numbers, and very few of them actually got any recovery from SIPC. The lawyer for SIPC, the lawyers there have been, you know, taking huge amounts of money as payment for their services. They should be doing their work pro bono. It's not just that, but they've changed the way that SIPC handled the Madoff case. Was they got the law changed in their favor to produce this definition of what they owe to and who has to repay money that was taken out. In effect, they call anybody who took money out in the 6 years before the fraud was discovered a thief. They're calling them a thief, and then they're going back and suing them for stealing money. That's what they're being accused of stealing money. It's double jeopardy. You could not only lose your entire retirement, you could not only not get paid your insurance, but then you get called a thief and get sued for a huge sum of money that you took out and you spent maybe on your mother's nursing home or your kid's education or you gave to charity. Now you're being sued for, in this example, $800,000, basically, or it could be a smaller amount. It doesn't matter. So no brokerage account today is safe until we get this bill passed.
It sounds like we can't trust, as investors, our financial system, and you can't trust your brokerage account. Our currency is losing purchasing power, and the price of goods and services continue to skyrocket. Would you agree, then, that there must be an alternative investment class with some appeal against these corrosive powers? One of them, obviously, precious metals.
Well, I think precious metals are one way to try and hedge your bet. So I think everybody should have some precious metals in their portfolio, whether you want to, you know, load up a huge fraction of your portfolio. I'm not sure I would advise that. There are other countries that you can invest in. For example, you could invest in the bonds of Chile, which is a very well-run economy with led by a lot of economists in terms of the top cabinet positions. You could invest in the government bonds of New Zealand or Australia or Canada. These are countries that are all fiscally solvent. You can diversify holdings of stocks around the world, and you can try and do that outside of a brokerage account. You can try and do that with a mutual fund company that has a third party custody where you're pretty darn sure that those securities that you've bought through your brokerage, through your mutual fund, actually are there. If you use, for example, Vanguard, and they invest, I think they probably use like State Street Bank, which is solely as custodian company, then you're pretty well assured that the money's safe. Or you could just try and buy securities directly and hold the certificates. You know, in effect, put the money under your mattress, put the stock certificates or the bond certificates under your mattress and not use a broker because you're suffering. You know, if you put money in a brokerage account, you cannot spend it for 6 years when you take it out because it can all be clawed back. Every penny you took out can be clawed back net of whatever you put in. And we hope and pray that that's a big number when you invest. And the older you are, the longer you've invested in a brokerage account, the more at risk you are. And then for a given length of investment periods, the better your broker has done, the more you've accumulated in that account. And therefore, if you take your money out, the more risk you're going to face. So everybody should be closing their brokerage account immediately. And the ones who have the most to worry about are the ones who've been in the longest in these brokerage accounts or have done the best in terms of rate of return.
Well, Professor Kotlikoff, we can't thank you enough today for just a very informative, enlightening discussion. You've given us so much food for thought. It's going to take us all, I'm sure, days, if not weeks, to digest all of this. We also appreciate the fact you may work around ivory towers, but you make time for the rest of us. So we wish you the best and continued success, sir.
Well, it was my pleasure, and none of us are really in ivory towers. If we're really, economists are supposed to be trying to understand the real world, and we better be in it to try to understand it. So I do, there are some economists who are in ivory towers, but most people are trying to really understand what's going on. So I think if economists were running our country, we wouldn't be in these kinds of problems. We have a government without a single PhD in economics, and Congress, as far as I understand, the people that are advising the Obama administration right now in economics, I've got no real credentials for doing this. I've got no top-level economists in the administration at this point. Anyway, great talking to you. We'll be in touch tomorrow, okay?
It's always a pleasure to have John Embry on the show, an industry expert in the precious metal sector. He knows these markets. Welcome back, John Embry.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, it's great to have you back. And I wonder if you could tell us about this remarkable precious metals rally we've seen this year. In the last 6 weeks alone, the market has exploded off of support levels. It looked like the end was nigh after a really strong start to the year. People seem to be getting nervous. I think they're nervous about the Middle East. They're nervous about Ukraine. They're nervous about the crumbling economy in Europe. And it looks like global investors in particular are flooding into the precious metals markets. Why don't we start there, please?
Well, I tell you, I think what you just said is all true. And I also think that gold is extraordinarily undervalued. You've got to realize it's fallen from 1900, it got down under 1200 in nearly 3 year period in which, we had QE everywhere. And it was a very counterintuitive move, and I think we're starting to retrace that. One of the things I think really having an impact on this is there's a growing shortage of physical gold, and I've been on record for some time saying that when the physical market takes over from this fraudulent paper market, that's when the action in the gold price is really going to get interesting.
Even the central banks are having trouble getting their gold back. Look at the Bundesbank over there. They're yellow metal back from France, from Paris, but they've virtually given up on receiving the bulk of their funds here from the United States. I think you're right when you talk about paper shenanigans.
This is a real tell, Chris. They have something in excess of 1,500 tons of gold held at the Federal Reserve in New York. There's some discussion asked for 300 tons back, which is less than 20% of what they have there. This was over a year ago, year and a half almost. And they were told that it would take 7 years to get it, which is really preposterous. You could put that in three planes and have it back in a week. But then to add insult to injury, a year passes and they got the grand total of 5 tons back. I think that tells you all you've got to know about how much gold continues to reside at the New York Fed that's available for other people to get a hold of. Next to nothing. And that down the road has enormous implications for the gold price, because they're not the only ones that are sort of hypothecating and rehypothecating the same ounce. I think there are so many claims of what gold still exists in the Western world that anybody that doesn't have physical possession of their gold or own something where it's audited and you know it's there is making a serious mistake, because you're going to get settled for paper before this is over.
We heard Professor Kotlikoff, who's warning people that he's closed out his brokerage accounts. He's recommending it to people. I mean, it's just not safe. And I think the real wake-up call there was MF Global. And we've seen subsequent other issues as well all around the globe. So I think your point is well made.
I'll give you an example. It's something that makes me very queasy. Here in Canada, I would say that we probably have one of the better banking systems in the world because we have five or six major banks. It's very oligopolistic, and it's a strong system relatively. But apparently, we put bail-in provisions legislated bail-in provisions, and that to me is unnerving because you wouldn't do something like that, you know, just unsettle the public unless there was a reason to do it. And I think people should be concerned.
Because if our officials are not working on our behalf, they're working on behalf of some banking cartel.
That's true, too.
I think they need to learn a little bit more from history, maybe from the French Revolution, when the government lost sight of the welfare of the everyday individual.
It's a very good point you make, because, I mean, as you know, I mean, there's been so much publicity latterly about this 1% versus the other rest of society. I read an interesting article by a billionaire out in Seattle talking about the pitchforks are coming. Mm-hmm. And I think that basically people that are in the privileged set should pay more attention to sort of what could go wrong here, because there's all sorts of problems out there. And there's an awful lot of people that I don't think realize how disadvantaged they're going to be before this is over.
We have a welfare state. I mean, we're talking about 150 million people or more, over half of our society here in the lower 48, over half of our society dependent on the federal government. So, I mean, if one thing goes wrong, one of those legs on this wobbly chair drop out, well, the whole system implodes, and what's going to put food on people's tables?
Well, I tell you, the greatest risk, I think, for North America, and most certainly for the United States, remains sort of the vulnerability of the U.S. currency. The U.S. has had an amazing opportunity over the past 65, 70 years at providing the world's reserve currency. Unfortunately, they've abused it. And what you see right now all around the world is sort of a growing disgust with the U.S. and its dollar. And, you know, all these various nations are talking about excluding the U.S. dollar in foreign transactions and this and that. If that happens, I think that the U.S. dollar will crack, and I mean, the impact that will have on living standards in North America will be extreme.
People have talked about it in the precious metals crowd for some time, implosion of the currency. Do you expect it to be a measured decline, as we've seen over the last 10, 15 years?
No, I don't. I think that when the day comes that there's a global realization that this is not going to be the reserve currency going forward, and that an awful lot of various nations are going to use something else to transact internationally, I think the conclusion could be more violent, and it won't be this gentle decline. It could fall precipitously at some point.
We're already seeing a repeat of an inflationary crisis, a currency crisis in South America, you know, just 13 years later. It's something that can happen overnight. I mean, you could wake up and you could have the same number of units of your currency in the bank account, but they might be devalued by 50% or more.
Well, interesting you'd mentioned South America. I just had the great good fortune of being in Buenos Aires a month ago for about 10 days. And so I was actually on the scene seeing what, you know, a serious debasement looks like. And it's really hard on the locals. It's great for the tourists because we were living high on the hog, but it really disrupts the standard of living for the locals. It's costs of things start to skyrocket and their incomes are sort of static.
This is a civilization and a region that was known for its affluence for quite some time. You know, I mean, maybe not in recent memory, but there was a long stretch in the last century where Argentina and that whole region were just known as the cosmopolitan center of the Southern Hemisphere.
Well, 1880s and 1920 was a golden era, and they built themselves spectacular infrastructure. I mean, the buildings and everything down there are exquisite. That's all over. I mean, now they're just hanging on.
Well, let's talk about some of the alternatives then. You know, we have precious metals as an alternative to currency disruption, and you also have the precious metal stocks that have just been on fire lately. Just a remarkable relief rally here. It looks as though maybe something more than just a dead cat bounce is in the cards. Any thoughts?
Chris, I'm on record as having said for some time now that this is probably the best opportunity to get into this space, maybe in my lifetime. And I think that not only are gold and silver extraordinarily cheap and have been under wraps here for at least the last 3 years when silver fell from 50 to 18 and gold went from 19 to under 1,200, but even worse than that, the stocks were annihilated. And they, relative to the bullion prices, are as cheap as I've ever seen them in my lifetime. So I think once the gold and silver prices get going, and it's not them that's going to move, it's the value of the paper money they're denominated in that are going to, it's going to be the arbiter of how high gold and silver prices go. But when this move gets underway, the impact on the stocks is going to be incredible. Like, I honestly believe that a number of the smaller companies I own are going to earn more in the next 2 to 3 years than they're currently trading for. In 1 year, they're going to earn more than they're currently trading for. That's how cheap they are.
Think of the billions of capital on the sidelines that will be leaving or looking for another home, let's say.
I think it's a point that's not understood by people who don't understand flows of capital. I mean, this space now has shrunk to such a minuscule amount. It's something like, I think all the gold stocks and silver stocks in the world are something like $300 billion in that area. And, I mean, that's a rounding error. I mean, like all the QE we've had is in trillions and trillions and trillions. And there's all these bonds and hundreds of trillions and stock market. All you need is a little piece of this capital to flow towards gold and silver shares, and the impact will be enormous.
If we turn the focus maybe for a moment to the silver market, where you have now 7 billion global inhabitants, you know, when they get their hands on a little bit of silver, a few silver coins here, a few silver quarters and whatnot, they're not going to part with it. It's not in their best interest.
Well, the silver story is a great one, Chris, because very simply, I mean, the vast majority of the silver coming out of the ground is being used in industrial and various applications, and they're growing, and there's sort of a lot of high-tech and interesting stuff. So there's not very much left over for investment. The above-ground inventories have been depleted dramatically over the last 40 to 50 years. There's very little above-ground inventory available. So consequently, when silver seems like a good idea, a real good idea as an investment, there isn't much there. So, I mean, I think the price action in silver when this gets underway, I mean, as much as bullish as I am on gold, I think silver is going to, the returns on gold. As a result, silver and silver stocks are just going to be on the moon before this is over.
Because you have those two competing forces, you know, the industrial demand, which obviously is on fire. Just take a look at platinum and palladium, which are primarily industrial here. So, I mean, you have that component, but then the precious metals component, which I think you could probably make the case that it hasn't even begun to have any traction with the typical investor.
That's absolutely correct. But there's something else that goes unremarked. The open interest on the COMEX, that's just the COMEX. God knows what's going on in the OTC market. The open interest in the COMEX is equal to the basic production of 1 year's mining production of silver. Short, 1 year's mining production of silver, 800 million ounces. So, I mean, it's enormous.
And, of course, we don't want to make fantastic claims, but it would certainly seem as though you're pointing towards a scenario where we could at least recoup the former peak posted back in 2011.
Oh, we'll easily go through that peak, Chris. And once that happens, that will attract a whole new group of investors. So, I mean, once it clears 50, I mean, the upside's open. Pick your number. I mean, if people calling for $150, I don't like picking numbers per se. All I'm saying is extraordinarily cheap. It's moving a long way on the upside. Very few people own it. And it's a great opportunity.
It sure is. And I wonder if there are any other topics that I haven't brought up today that you'd like to leave with the listening audience.
The one important thing that people have to realize, despite all the rhetoric coming out of central banks and Janet Yellen and yak, 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 is that they have no option. The world is afloat in just a wash in debt. Much of it is becoming increasingly less serviceable. And the only thing that can keep it from imploding on our heads and leading to a depression which will exceed anything we could have imagined in the 1930s is in more and more liquidity being introduced into the system. The U.S. will reverse this sort of no QE stuff they're talking about. The European Bank is going to paper that over. China's going to have to print incredible amounts of money. It's going to lead to a worldwide debasement of paper currencies and probably, and without question, in full time, a new currency system. And I think gold will be introduced into that system. All of this is extraordinarily bullish for precious metals, and very few people seem to have grasped that point
I mean, we're looking at a time where people are just going to be caught off guard if they don't start making contingencies now.
It's shocking to me that this is obvious to a few of us. And I mean, I discuss this with a number of people who share my point of view. But we're in such a small minority that it's remarkable to me that people can't see this.
Are there any individual stocks that you'd like to share? I don't want to put you on the spot.
No, I mean, I own a couple of smaller ones up here in Canada, like Lakeshore Gold, LSG, and the TSX, Westome, WDO, and the TSX. I own them in size. Ontario-based producers, so they have no geopolitical risk. They both are in production with first-class quality mining infrastructure. They have significant reserves. And I think both of them will earn more than they're trading for when my gold price predictions are realized.
What should the typical investor have? I mean, what percentage?
That's a great question, because back in the 1970s when you had to have gold and silver, I mean, you could get away with 10% because if you had 10%, there was such enormous appreciation in both gold, silver, and the shares that it offset anything else that was going wrong in your portfolios. Now, I would say that this time things are infinitely worse than they were in the 70s. And at the same time, gold and silver shares are even cheaper in relation to all the other financial assets than they were in the 70s. So I would be very comfortable with saying people should have at least 20 to 25%, at least.
Very good. And that's your bottom figure. And for the typical person listening, they would want to maybe start rolling out of some of those equities profits and directing them into the metals.
And bonds, too. Bonds and equities, general equities. I think that you should, you've done very well in both of them. They're both overpriced and in bubbles to some extent. I think this is a perfect time to be rolling out of some of that into gold and silver, which remain remarkably cheap in comparison.
When are we going to see a non-gold aficionado investor, someone with deep pockets, step up and say, you know what, this is a market that I need, a Warren Buffett or a George Soros?
That's a good question, because I think some of them are probably doing it clandestinely. I mean, you don't want to make that announcement now, because, I mean, if it's some guy who is viewed as not one of us gold bugs said that, I mean, he'd blow the top off the top of the market. That'll happen, but not until they get their positions to the extent possible. What do you think the Chinese are doing? I mean, they're buying up every ounce on earth, and they're not saying a thing.
They don't publish their numbers the way we do.
No, I mean, they've got infinitely more than they've admitted to. And I mean, and I think, quite frankly, they're probably involved in the paper suppression of the gold price for the simple reason that it allows them to get the real stuff cheap. And when they can't get any more, that's when it gets marked up, and it's going to be marked up huge at that point.
I saw one article on Gata.org that showed that we're talking as much as 900 million ounces in the first 6 months of their year they've consumed. You know, that's not too far from the annual output of gold.
I know. I mean, you don't know, I mean, what they're doing. All you know is they have a huge surfeit of U.S. dollars in various forms. They realize that the U.S. dollar is in jeopardy. I mean, they bought $22 billion worth of U.S. houses in the last year. I mean, they're getting rid of this stuff for real assets, and I'm sure gold is at the top of the list.
So you're not too worried then about this story coming from mainland China that there was some fraudulent activity involving gold and that that might lead to much lower imports. You think that's, you know, an anecdote?
No, I know the story. I mean, this is all this collateral that they were using over there. I mean, to me, the gold that was allegedly there to support this collateral is gone. To me, that's bullish, not bearish. I alluded to it earlier, Chris, and I think it's extraordinarily important for people to know that there are so many claims on each ounce that exists in the system, paper claims, that when this unbelievable Ponzi scheme comes to an end, the impact on the price is going to be extreme in a positive sense.
The confluence of events all coming together in one focal point.
And you know, I think the guys on the other side of the trade, the bullion banks et al., know this. And, I mean, they're messing around in the paper markets right now because they've knocked it down for the last couple of days. But to me, this is just, you know, business as usual, and it's setting up for an upside explosion. I think it's pretty imminent.
Well, you know, we had your friend Bill Murphy on last week. Some of his research indicates that J.P. Morgan may have gone short something like 6 or 7 times the amount of paper, and they also bought us a fraction of the silver, and they've been throwing that into the market over the past 3 years, and that they've run out of silver physical to suppress the market.
I've discussed this with Bill. I mean, it's the best theory I've seen on how they were able to take the silver price from 50 to 19. I mean, basically, the silver market physically was extraordinarily tight in the latter stages of that run to 50. And now it's becoming, the suggestion by some insiders is that the major buyer was J.P. Morgan, the physical. At the same time they were getting long this physical amount, they were shorting massive amounts of paper. And they've made infinitely more on the paper short on the decline than they lost in the physical long. And they've been able to use the physical long to supply the necessary amount of silver that allow the paper short to drive it lower. In fact, if it's true, and it could well be, I mean, it's all speculation. Brilliant ploy. And I mean, J.P. Morgan may be a little shady, but they're smart. So that's as good a theory that I've heard. I've heard other people speculate that the Chinese lent interest a whole bunch of silver so they could get the silver and gold prices. There's all sorts of speculation, but somewhere a significant amount of silver was made available to permit this takedown from 50.
I want to make sure that you have, you know, your final thought here for our listeners. You always have a nugget of wisdom. Maybe you could give people an idea of just how you'd start accumulating if they're new to the precious metals market.
Well, I think it's extremely important to get started right this minute. And I think that I would actually be putting a little more emphasis on the shares today, buying. But I would also, you've got to do the research on the quality of the shares. That if you don't want to get caught with the wrong vehicle in the event of a huge move up, and this was the one that doesn't have the goods. So it's important that you do the homework on the shares. But doing that, I think the more junior shares have the greatest upside. But the real core of your portfolio will always be your gold and silver in your possession.
And I want to reiterate that 20 to 25% minimum.
I think at this point in time, the value relative to the more traditional financial assets, urban real estate at all, is extremely positive in favor of gold and silver and gold and silver shares.
Exactly. And, you know, and even if we're wrong, you know, you still have your core position diversified. So it's just a win-win scenario. 25% or more, folks, it's time to step up. Got discount prices. What more do you need? You've got John Embry here. And you've got discounted prices. I mean, that's all I need to go buy some precious metals today.
Hopefully people are listening because to date, they just basically have been influenced by, you know, negative price action. And they've avoided the sector. It will be seen in the fullness of time as a serious mistake.
We so appreciate your thoughts and your time today. It's quite valuable to all of us. And we're going to look forward to having you back on the show, sir.
Chris, as you know, it's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Tragedy abounds and speculation is rampant regarding the cause and effect of the downed Malaysian passenger plane over Ukraine. As with crises of this magnitude, access to information is being managed. Mainstream questions are being organized with certain acceptable parameters of debate, and both military and political outcomes are being embedded not only into questions on the subject, but also into what are supposed to be intellectually honest, fact-finding discussions on the subject. If you listen carefully, questions and commentaries seem to contain the subtle prelude to conflict, intervention, and war. In fact, there's nothing subtle about it. It's overt. The pretending game media and politicians are once again playing is that of supposed inquiry and objectivity about what should be done about this. They know darn well what is likely to come. A surrogate or direct war. End of story. There's no transparency about it. We are at a very dangerous juncture on the world stage. Derivatives, the weapon of mass destruction referred to by Warren Buffett, can explode at any moment, rendering the global economy obsolete. Or they can detonate in lesser stages, wreaking havoc regionally or systemically around the globe. Since we've effectively run out of bailouts, the next financial fix-it solution will be bail-ins, which means, in the next crisis, banks will attempt to recapitalize themselves by confiscating a portion of lost funds from their creditors, which includes not only their shareholders and bondholders, but most of all, their largest creditor, you, the depositor. Ultimately, the response to the downed airliner may lead to military intervention in the Ukraine, which could involve the United States, either directly or indirectly. Military action, or the speculation thereof, impacts economies the world over, which we know are withering on the vine in their own respect, despite whatever rhetoric one reads. Don't believe me? Ask yourself how life in the U.S. would change, literally overnight, if the 50 million people who receive food stamps went off them tomorrow and had no more access to basic food supplies. The U.S. has already changed, just like Canada has already changed, and most other countries. We just haven't fully admitted it to ourselves as of yet. By the same token, the world itself has already changed, and we just haven't fully admitted that to ourselves as of yet either. Perhaps the coming conflict we are being psychologically prepared for will open our eyes. It may indeed, but it will open them to a battle and a world that was lost long ago. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.